Dr. Vali Nasser is Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and has distinguished himself as a Middle East scholar, author, foreign policy advisor, and commentator on international relations. He is a contributing writer at the New York Times and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Prior to his current appointment at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Nasser taught international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. From 2009 to 2011, he was a special advisor to the President's Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Dr. Nasser has been a Carnegie Scholar, a senior fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and an adjunct senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a member of the U.S. Department of State's Foreign Affairs Policy Board, a director of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the National Democratic Institute, and a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has authored several books on foreign policy, Iraq, and on the Arab Spring. Dr. Nasser earned a PhD in political science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dean Vali Nasser?
Good morning. Thank you very much for that warm introduction. It's wonderful being here at BYU, a school that has a great deal of legacy in the study of international affairs and has trained many scholars and practitioners in this field. It is perhaps fortuitous for us to be talking about the Middle East now. It has become a very big foreign policy concern, and we're dealing with some very complicated issues in that region. However, thinking back, it looks like for the past four decades, we have been dealing with the Middle East as a top foreign policy problem in one form or another. In fact, there is no other region of the world that has held our gaze in such constancy and yet also with so much frustration, I would say, than the Middle East. It just seems like we cannot find our way in either dissociating or disentangling ourselves from the Middle East or finding a way to comfortably deal with problems over there. The administration of President George Bush tried very boldly to once and for all fix the region through a radical surgery, if you would, of invasion of Iraq and bringing about a democratic government in Iraq. It was an experiment that failed, and many came away from that experiment thinking that American power had met its limits in terms of being able to shape the world in a way that it would be comfortable with it. President Obama's administration followed a very different tact of basically wanting to rid itself of the Middle East, of focusing on other areas of the world like Asia or Latin America, and set out about a policy of trying to distance itself from the region and its troubles. And it took two heinous beheadings of American journalists over the past few months to basically reverse that policy, for us to realize that it's not as easy to wash our hands of the Middle East. You know, the long and short of it is that the issues that we deal with in the Middle East, and I'll go over some of them, are not simple and are very complicated. And it's really at institutions like BYU, it's at universities, in the education of young people like you, that we have to look for the deeper understanding, the acquisition of knowledge that is languages, analytic and historical knowledge that is necessary in order to deal with these sorts of complicated issues. At a higher level, I think the Middle East really beckons understanding and engagement. And that actually for me has been very much of a personal journey. A big event in the Middle East in 1979 in the form of a major revolution upended my world. I was about the age to go to university when that happened. My family had to leave Iran. And actually, of all places, we first came to Utah, to Salt Lake City, where we were there for a number of months until we found our feet, and I ended up going to college in the United States. But for me, it became very clear that that creating that understanding was really the single biggest vocation that was necessary. And for not somebody who had been in the eye of the storm and was firsthand watching the way in which Americans were reacting to the enigma of the Iranian Revolution, that this was going to be a long haul, and it became basically the mission of my life, first in academia and then in government, of trying to provide a better understanding about the Middle East. Because I ultimately think that our faith is so entwined with that region that we're not going to be able to happily move beyond it without dealing with it, and we need to deal with it, and to deal with it, we need to understand it. And it really is that simple. Now, you know, I have these conversations with policymakers, with journalists, with academics. You know, we have to begin from the fundamental issues that I raised. Why are we so concerned with that region? Why can't we just leave it alone? And why is it doesn't leave us alone, let's say? Why can't we just wash our hands of it? There are troubles in Africa or in Latin America, and it doesn't seem to be as consuming as the Middle East is. For the longest period of time, the answer was oil, that we really have to pay attention to this region because it's oil-rich and because we need oil. And now often people say, well, you know, we don't need oil anymore. In a few years' time, the United States will be producing more oil than Saudi Arabia with the revolutions that we're seeing in extraction of shale oil in the U.S. So we don't need the Middle East. Why don't we leave them alone? The problem is that that's a fallacy. We haven't been consuming Middle East oil for a very, very long time. If you go back 20 years ago, you know, that shift started. When we went into Iraq during President Bush's time, America was only importing maybe 10-15% of its oil from the Middle East. Most of its oil comes from Mexico and Latin America and the west coast of Africa. And most of Middle East's oil actually doesn't come to the United States. It goes to Asia. It goes to China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, and those places. So in reality, oil has not been the glue that keeps us with that region. There are other important issues. We found out in 9/11, and again recently with the rise of this group in Iraq and Syria known as ISIS, that terrorism, instability, insurgency is really worrisome to us. And that actually is one reason why we are engaged in this region. If Americans 5 years ago thought, you know, we have shale oil, we don't need the Middle East, let's leave and go to Asia, that's still true. It's terrorism that is bringing us back to the region. And then there is the issue of security of Israel. Many Americans are deeply concerned about stability and security of Israel. And guess what? Israel is in the Middle East. There's no way in which you could say that we are interested in Israel, its future, its stability, its security, but we don't want to have anything to do with the Middle East. And therefore, so long as Israel is in the Middle East and we care about Israel, we're going to need to deal with the Middle East. And again, that point came home very clearly. If you remember just a few months ago when there was a big war between Israel and Palestinians in Gaza, guess which country was called upon to find a way to bring that conflict to an end? It was the United States. Now, if we can get clear that, you know, there is a set of issues that makes us interested in this region, it would be much easier for us to put our heads around how do we deal with it. But having said that, when you talk to policymakers or you talk to media, there are things about this region that seem peculiar to people. Why is it such an outlier? Why hasn't there been a democratic revolution in the Middle East like we've seen in Latin America or in Asia? why isn't we have more globalization and capitalism and trade and business with the Middle East the way we have with the rest of the world? All of which are very fair questions. We often, the answers come to another problem we see in the region. Why does this region have too much religion? That there's too much Islam in the Middle East, right? And there are many responses to this. Some of it, you know, points to cultural features in the region. Some of it tries to say that Islam is a particularly political religion. But, you know, by and large, this is not as enigmatic as we think. First of all, the rise of religion and its relevance to politics is not unique to the Middle East. We're seeing it in the United States. We're seeing it in Latin America. We're seeing it in Israel. We're seeing it in India. We're seeing it in many areas around the world, that there is generally a return to religious values in politics. That secularism as we know it, or as we've celebrated it in academia, in public policy, is losing ground. And in the Middle East, that's the case as well. Except in the Middle East, it is doing so with a vengeance and with much greater consequences. And one important reason it's doing it, which is something often our policymakers don't quite understand, is that secularism in the Middle East has failed. I don't mean secularism as a sense of an idea, that it's good to keep God out of public affairs and focus on only secular issues in politics. But secularism as politics has failed. So when you go to the Middle East and tell people secularism is great, they would ask you, have secular governments provided economic development? And the answer is no. Have they been good governments? The answer is no. Have they won wars? The answer is no. Have they given us power? Have they given us stature in the world? The answer is no. So if the answer to all of these things is no, why is secularism a good thing? I mean, in the end, the proof of these things is in what they deliver to you. On the other hand, people in the Middle East have come to see religion as answering many of these things. So they associate what Islamic fundamentalists or Islamic forces promise them. They associate that with good government. They associate that with better social services, better education, more economic development. And in many cases, they look at whether it's ISIS in Iraq or Syria or Hamas in Palestinian territories as these people are actually willing to fight, and they put up a better fight than secular forces do. If you look in recent decades, the only military victory the Arabs have enjoyed, at least a qualified military victory they have enjoyed, happened in the hands of the fundamentalist Lebanese organization Hezbollah, where it forced Israel to withdraw its troops from southern Lebanon. So, by and large, the problem is that the forces that we support in the region, that we would like to see work in the region, are not doing well by the people of the region. And Islam basically has become a voice of dissent, the alternative, the foil. And until such time as you have a secular government that actually delivers, that actually is successful economically, that actually provides a semblance of power and prestige in the eyes of the population, we're not going to see a triumph of secularism. Now, just another wrinkle that we're seeing has been created in recent years is that, okay, Islam is important in the region. We have to deal with it. We have to find a way to coexist with it. Now, why is the region sinking into sectarianism? For most Americans, this is something new. I remember conversations where policymakers would say, well, what is this Shia and Sunni thing? Right? I thought they were all Arabs. Or a refrain we often hear is that why can't they just coexist together as Iraqis and Syrians? Again, well, you know, sectarianism matters because it's about identity, right? There are times when the way you practice a religion basically defines you, who you are. I mean, religion at some levels is the language of your daily interactions. And if you're speaking a different language in your daily interaction, in your ethics, in the way you approach your life, then that separates you from other people as if you were really speaking a different language. Now, the Muslim world is over a billion people. Of them, about 15% are Shia. But 90% of that 15% live in an area between India and Lebanon, which is the heart of the Middle East. Now, when I used to say these things, people would tell me, well, if that's true, then how come we had never heard of them before? And I would say that's exactly where the problem is. Because you have had this silent, invisible, large population, which is almost equal number to the Sunnis in this region, but has had no voice. You had countries like Iraq, in which the Shias were 65% of the population, but they were ruled by a minority. And as a result, whenever a division of power, money you get from government, number of quotas you get for students at university, loans you get from a bank to do your business, is decided by who you are, then that makes that division politicized. So in Iraq, everybody speaks Arabic. They may come from the same city. They're the same ethnic background. What separates them is whether they're the Shia or the Sunni. So I remember when I was doing research, I would talk to Shia businessmen who generally were secular. They were not necessarily very vigilante religious figures. And they would say things like, you know, there was no Shia-Sunni issue before Americans came to Iraq. And, you know, we all lived close to one another, and it was only until American invasion of Iraq that we had a Shia-Sunni issue. And these are all your fault. And we say, okay, that's fine. Now, tell me about your business in Iraq. And then the more they spoke, they would say, well, we couldn't get bank loans because all the bank loans went to Sunnis. And we couldn't get membership of the Ba'ath Party unless we denounced who we were. And the more they talked, it was very clear that it was about a discrimination what you get, what you can do, how high you can go, and you're basically how you can operate based on who you are. And the who you are part of it is based on your belief. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you need to be a mosque-going Shia in that sense. You are who you are. I mean, Shiism basically becomes your identity. Now, that's not something that is completely unfamiliar to Americans as well. I mean, when your faith basically becomes your identity marker. Now, this has now exploded in the region for the reason that the boundaries of governments that were containing this relationship are collapsing. And when those boundaries collapse, these fights that are simmering below come out in the open. When the U.S. military invaded Iraq in 2003 and broke down Saddam Hussein's regime, I mean, some of you are too young to remember. I can't believe I would be saying that, but it's true. What we thought is that we are liberating Iraqis from a dictatorship, right? But what we didn't realize is that there are different degrees of liberation that was happening. So the Sunnis were being liberated from dictatorship. The Shiites were being liberated from dictatorship, but they also were being liberated from Sunni domination. That nuance we didn't get. And then we said, okay, there's going to be elections here. Elections is about one man, one vote. That's great. That means majority takes over. Dictatorship gives power to minority, democracy gives power to the majority. So essentially, the single most important task that the United States achieved in Iraq was to transfer Iraq from Sunnis to Shias. That is our historical legacy in the region. We helped create the first Arab-Shia state It didn't exist before. There were Shias in the region, they were part of the system, but every Arab state was dominated by Sunnis, whether they were majorities or they were minorities. And our invasion of Iraq essentially achieved this massive historical fact. And if you looked at Iraq today, if you looked at the news today, basically Iraqis are still not reconciled to this. This whole uprising of ISIS, the fact that Sunnis in Iraq support ISIS is because Sunnis in Iraq are still not reconciled to Shias ruling over Iraq. So yes, we admonish the Iraqi government and we say you ought to be nicer to Sunnis, you ought to give them more things, you ought to bring them in. That's all true. But these people used to rule and now you're giving them crumbs. And ultimately the anger still is about what we did. And if you said one appeal ISIS has in Iraq is that ISIS wants to undo what the United States achieved in 2003, or we didn't seek to achieve it. It was a consequence of what we tried to do in Iraq. So we gave Iraq to the Shias, and then we tried very hard to make them coexist with each other and say, well, you know, now you guys all play nice in the sandbox with each other. But we couldn't control how people reacted to this massive shift in power. Now, what we did in Iraq, this phenomenon of Arab Spring, you know, the uprisings that happened the past 3 or 4 years in the Arab world, achieved in Syria and in many other places, which is the popular uprisings broke down dictatorship. When you break down dictatorship, this fight over between majority and minority comes out. Syria was the reverse of Iraq. You had a majority Sunni population ruled by a minority dictatorial regime. The uprisings created a situation when it looked like the Sunnis in Syria could take over. There, the minority government looked at what happened in Iraq and said, we're going to fight to the knife with this one. We're not going to give up. And Syria has descended into chaos, largely because it's a fight over dictatorship, but it's also a fight over which community will rule over Syria. Now, we had never figured that we're going to deal with the Middle East that is actually collapsing into these kinds of fights, that you actually have large countries collapse, and the most important fights become between which community is going to rule and what they come out with it. I mean, we hadn't seen these kinds of fighting in Western history since the medieval period. But as bad as these are not as unknown to us and to our history and to European history. So what is happening in Syria and Iraq today? What is it that, how should we look at this? So you have an organization that has grown, which is a vicious, extremely fanatical organization that has grown by the name of ISIS, that now controls a vast territory and has fashioned itself as a caliphate, as an Islamic state. The very fact that it's done that evokes a certain amount of appeal to different constituencies, to young people in Europe, young Muslims in Europe who volunteer to go and join this organization, it may be giving them an aura of power. That, you know, it's the first time in a very long time that a force in the region has defied international power, is defeating local governments to create a territory and rule over territory. This is an enormous statement of power, which is very appealing to a region where has been humiliated over a long period of time in war after war going forward. Secondly, it's very appealing to Sunni voices in the region because many in the region look at what's happening in Iraq and Syria as a Shia-Sunni fight. And then you have other countries that have come into this, like Saudi Arabia has been backing the Sunnis and Iran has been backing the Shias. And in the middle of this, basically ISIS is fighting the Sunni cause. in Iraq, it's speaking for the Sunnis fighting the Shia government. In Syria, it is fighting against the Kurds and the government, which are not representing the Sunnis and are non-Sunni forces. So we're dealing, if you would, with this sectarian issue playing itself out in the region in a very big way. But it's even bigger than that. The Middle East, the map of the Middle East, when you look at this region, was created at the end of World War I. When World War I finished, and we're this year, 2014, is the centennial of the start of World War I. When it finished in 1918, diplomats got in a room and decided on the peace. They didn't do a very good job in Europe, as we know. It began to fall apart very quickly. They didn't do a very good job in the Middle East. The French and the British in particular sat down, took the Arab territories, and basically took a pencil and drew boundaries and divided it among themselves. So the Syria went to the French, Iraq went to the British. They had this massive area called Palestine. They gave a part of it to the British, which then became Israel. And then a piece of it, they basically said, why don't we create a new country, which is called Jordan now. It's well known that Churchill, sitting in a hotel in the Middle East, wrote a check for £600,000 and gave it to the great-grandfather of the current king of Jordan. He said, here's £6,000 and 6 months. Let's see if the idea works. So they basically drew the map of this region, and the map held, unhappily, but it held. There were periods we saw unhappiness with it, like when Iraq invaded Kuwait. Well, Kuwait had been part of Iraq. The British, after World War I, made it a separate country. The Iraqis never were reconciled to that. They tried to take it back by force, and they were slapped fairly heavily on their hands. But generally, the map held. Now the map is coming apart. The map is actually dissolving as we speak. So if you looked at ISIS, again, this one organization, what is most significant about it is that it has completely erased the boundary between Syria and Iraq. It controls a territory that starts in northern Syria and goes all the way to southern Iraq. And that basically means that this is the first time, anybody in the region has been able to erase the map that the British and the French drew in 1918 in a very meaningful, big way. If ISIS gets to keep this territory, if it ends up to rule over this territory, then essentially the map of this region will change in a very big way. Secondly, over the years, we've been used to dealing with governments in the region. We have friends. We call them when we have trouble. We look to them to do things. Now all of our friends are falling apart themselves. They're under pressure. Some of them are collapsing. They're threatened by ISIS as well. And that puts a lot of pressure on the United States to actually deal much more directly with the Middle East. Now, the question is often, well, is there a solution? Is there a way out? There's no quick fix. This is too big a problem to say that there is a quick fix. And what we can do is to try to help to contain ISIS and to also bring some kind of a closure to the wars in Syria and Iraq. And that's not going to happen in short order, but there is a path to ultimately some kind of a negotiation over power sharing between Shias and Sunnis in these countries that would persuade them that they don't need to fight over power. They can share it. But in the longer run, the solution to this region ultimately requires economic growth and business. The Middle East also has a very large middle class that is no different from middle classes elsewhere. So if we looked at a completely different set of data, about who uses Facebook and Twitter, how much of it is used, engagement with technology and entrepreneurship, we see that, you know, there are pockets of the same kind of middle classes that we see elsewhere in the world that could basically be the engine of change in this region. The problem is that they are captured in economies that are closed, that are dominated by governments, and are secluded from the world order. And again, you know, this is something that the United States is very good at doing. We've helped economic growth in Mexico, in Latin America, in Asia. And so when the dust settles from ISIS, that is actually the task that lies before us and lies before your generation going forward. And let me stop there with that. Thank you.